the conveners of the conference to invite me to come and speak here, and I feel really honoured to be among so many distinguished scholars of Harfest. In some ways, I feel a fraud to be here. But I think what we have to notice that today we would not be here but for the work of early Orientalists. And to understand how Harfest was presented to the early English-speaking world, we have to understand how the early Orientalists presented Harfest to this world. Now, in most respects, English poetry during the greater part of late 18th century were voices whose intonation and subject matter were essentially classical. Simplification though it might be, there is much in the literature of the time that's only explicable in terms of the imitations and of the classical authors. Much that is primarily designed to please classically trained tastes. The authors of Greece and Rome provided literally models, provided models of civilized thought, artistic structure, procedures of argument, and methods of ethical analysis. Yet for all the ideals of the Augustinianism, they were also run through the literature of the age a significantly different undercurrent. Other writers and other scholars were turning not always consistently and not always with great understanding to the consideration of other rather different literary traditions. There were native linguistic and literary traditions like Anglo-Saxon, there were Welsh, there were Gaelic, there were European literature like Scandinavian, Icelandic and Germanic, and also Middle Eastern influences, such as the Arabian Nights was making a mark, and many of the significant developments are outlined in John Holloway's aptly titled Widening Horizons in English Verse. Such new and renewed literary traditions were an important conditioning factor in the emergence of English romanticism. Translations of Persian poetry, and specifically of Hafez, played an important role in this expansion of the resources of English verse, which had hitherto been more or less homogeneous, intense but relatively narrow, now widened and divided. The available repertoire of themes and forms and thus enormously was enlarged. It was in terms such as these that Sir William Jones more than once justified and recommended the study of Oriental literature. In the preface to his poems consisting chiefly of translations from the Asiatic languages, which was published in 1772, he explains that it is very desirous of recommending to the learned world a species of literature which abounds with so many new expressions, new images, and new inventions. Jones clearly felt that such a transfusion of new poetic blood was something from which the Western tradition could derive great benefit. As he argues in his essay on the poetry of Eastern nations, he writes, "I cannot but think that our European poetry has subsisted too long on the perpetual repetition of some images and incessant allusions to the same fables." He goes on to say that we should have a more extensive insight into the history of the human mind. We should be furnished with a new set of images and similitudes, and a number of excellent compositions would be brought to light, which future scholars might explain and future poets might imitate. Now, as we shall see, there were English poets who actually took Jones's invitation and responded to the this material and study these images and similitudes and compositions, which he and his fellow translators made available to them. Jones was the first translator of Hafez, as everybody knows, into English, and for a long while was the most influential of such a translator. There was, of course, other translations available, not in English, but they were in Latin, of Thomas Hyde's translation, there were mentions of Hafez in several travel books, but nothing concrete. Soon, however, there was no reason for the poets to limit their dealings with the Persian poetry and just use an oriental color. In the works of such scholars as Count Revisky, I'm not sure whether I'm pronouncing this right, and especially Sir William Jones, largely accurate translations and paraphrases were increasingly made available. Considerable resources of scholarship were employed in the elucidation and cultural background. Analysis of meter and rhyme scheme gave opportunities for the understanding of a distinctly non-classical set of poetic principles. Of course, Jones and his fellow translators could not be other than men of their own time. Their training had been within the classical tradition. What they now found, what they now, in the literary sense, colonized, they naturally tended to assimilate to that same tradition. Their understanding and interpretation of a poet such as Hafez was necessarily conditioned by their own critical background. As such, it is hardly surprising that such translators and scholars should be seduced into the false position of seeking to recommend Hafez, not because of his own intrinsic virtues, but in terms of his similarities, real or supposed, with the classical poets. The strategy produced some unhelpful and occasionally implausible parallels. It is perhaps seen in its purest form in Jones's Dissertation sur la littérature orientale, where a poem by Hafez and a poem by Horace are translated into the neutral language of French, and the reader is invited to compare the two. More often than not, it is the Anacreon that Hafez is related to and compared to. Jones's Traité sur la poésie orientale contains the statement that the lyrics of Hafez are like those of the Greek Anacreon. Now, the first translation in John Knott's collection is described by its translator as an ode which is truly bacchanalian and might alone entitle our poet to the appellation of the Anacreon of Persia. Richardson's notes contain such observations as passages similar to this occur frequently in the ancient Greek and Roman poets, particularly in Anacreon and Horace. And Hindley describes Hafez as the polished Anacreon of Iran. The identification indeed becomes so commonplace that a popularizer such as Costello could, without argument or analysis, entitle her chapter on the poet Hafez the Persian Anacreon. There is, of course, a great deal that it is misleading in such an identification, yet for all that it is necessarily misleading and gives a false picture of the real nature of Hafez's work, it may paradoxically have been important in making his works relatively approachable for English readers and writers. Had he first been presented to the public, as Leili was saying earlier on, simply as a mystical poet writing within a learned symbolic tradition, he would simply have been too alien a figure, his work too radically foreign for him to have attracted admirers and imitators. His early English translators were all of them aware that there was more to Hafez than the analogy with Anacreon could ever imply, but it was chiefly in the Anacreonic guise that they chose successfully to present him to a new public. As such, his work could be seen as more of an extension of the classical tradition than a serious alternative to it. Now, those of you who know Jones, that you know that time and time again, he goes to Hafez for illustrating his arguments. There are chunks of translations from Hafez in almost all his essays. And of course, he translated 10 poems in French, which are attached to his History of Nadershah in French. And he also translated in Latin, and he's translated into English. But his one poem, which became very popular in late 18th century, was the translations of the Turkish Shiraz Ghazal. And it became almost, you know, and the Romantics read Jones almost without exception. They all read Jones, and they became very, very familiar with him. I mean, Thomas More read the Oriental scholars, notably the translators of Hafez, and particularly of Notes. In the notes to Lalla Rukh makes references, among others, to Sir William Jones, Gore Ouseley's Persian Miscellany, Scott Waring, and not translations, of course. It is chiefly in Lalla Rukh that one can discern the influence of Moore's reading of Hafez's translations. It is characteristic that when the irritable critic Fadhluddin dismisses the poem he has just heard, he should complain that it lacked the sweetness of Hafez, or that when Lalla Rukh finds the opportunity to sit in the garden with the youthful poet, it should be a garden of which it can be said that, I quote, you've got that on your first quotation or on more, every precious flower was there to be found that poetry or love or religion has ever consecrated, from the dark hyacinth to which Hafez compares his mistress's hair to the Kamalata by whose rosy blossoms the heaven of Indra is centered. Moore's notes for the passage refer us to Notes Hafez Ode 5. And Sir William Jones, Notes Ode 5 includes the lines, "The gale shall spread yon hyacinth wreath over the warm bosom of the blushing rose." Now, which Not judges this line very alien, a very alien image, so he goes on to expand a whole paragraph of notes to it. When Moore informs us that the poet of Delhi had described Lalla Rukh as more perfect than the divinest images in the house of Azor, it is again to Hafez that the notes refer as for explanation. There are many other passages in the poem which no Hafezian source is quoted, but you know, which are obviously influenced by the poetry of Hafez. I mean, I have they're just too long for me to quote here. I mean, they will go into the published form, but if I want to do that, I will never speak of any of the others. Now, Lalla Rukh is not a poem which is now regarded as at all highly. It certainly embodies no very real perception of the Oriental world. G.M. Vickers has condemned it as a work in which character, posture, motivation, and action are all grotesquely romantic and European. Yet, in its day, Moore's poem was quite remarkably successful. he gave perfect expression, it would appear, to one important dimension of the taste of his time. And I quote here, Lalo Roche was at once an immense success. It was continually reissued in this country, and 20 years after his first appearance, his publisher referred to it as the cream of the copyrights. It was quickly translated into many foreign languages. Chateaubriand sang its praises. Stendhal said that he had read it 5 times. And when Goethe told Eckermann that since he was ignorant of Greek and Latin, he had better learn English, the language of Byron, Moore, and Scott, and he was thinking of Lalo Roche. Now, as a phenomenon in the history of taste, Lalo Roche cannot be ignored. In essence, it can be seen as the popularization, and indeed of the vulgarization of the Jones-inspired movement of the Oriental study. But better poets than Moore were also reading Jones and not Hindley and Richardson, and that is to say, becoming familiar with Hafez. Sir William Jones's Persian Song was in 1811 apparently so much and so assuredly in the minds of the captivated man that Byron, writing to Robert Charles Dulles, could allude to it by way of emphasis. He says, "My dear sir, as Gifford has been ever my Magnus Apollo, any appropriation such as you mention would of course be more welcome than all Bukhara's wanted gold than all the gems of Samarkand." So the modern editor of Byron's letters observes that Jones' translation, that Byron wrote a parody called The Barmaid, which was never published, at the MS in the Murray collection. In fact, the poem was published a few years later, I'm not quite sure about the date, in the collected works of Byron. And I have here, you've got on your handout, printed out the first and last stanzas of both Jones's Persian Song and Byron's Barmaid. So I'll read you first the Persian Song, Jones's translation. It said, "Sweet maid, if thou wouldst charm my sight, and did these arms thy neck enfold, that rosy cheek, that lily hand, would give thy poet more delight than all Bukhara's wanted gold, than all the gems of Samarkand." And then he finishes with, "Go boldly forth, my simple lay, whose accents flow with artless ease, like orient pearls at random strung, thy notes are sweet, the damsels say, but oh, far sweeter, if they please, thy nymph for whom these notes are sung." And now we've got a parody of Byron. Says, "Barmaid, if for this shilling white thou'st let me love, nor scratch or scold, that ruddy cheek and ruddier hand would give my bardship more delight than all the ale that ever was sold, than ever, that even a pot of cider." And then he finishes, go boldly forth, my parody, whose stanzas flows just as I please, like Lord knows what, to say any tune. My notes are brisk, as brisk can be, but ah, much brisker might I seize the maid for whom I turn a buffoon." So Byron was a satirizer. So in this poem we have a satire, but he was reading other poems from Hafez, and the effect can be seen in his poetry. I mean, in 2 poems, particularly the Giavor, which is incidentally the name for gore. I have written a long essay on Persian influences on Byron, and I've been asked many a times, where does the name come from? And I went through many, many of Oriental dictionaries, and especially with this spelling, G-I-A-O-U-R, And eventually, I found it in Derblo's Bibliothèque Orientale. And that's why he's written it in that way. It literally means gore, you know, the Zoroastrians or the infidels, as it were. And here you've got in your handout a passage from the Giovo, which are very reminiscent of Harfez's imagery. Her eyes, dark charm, it were vain to tell, but gaze on that of the gazelles. It will assist thy fancy well, as large as languishing dark, but soul beamed forth in every spark that darted from beneath the lid, bright as the jewel of Jamshid. On her might muftis might gaze and own that through her eye the immortal shone. On her fair cheeks and fading hue, the young pomegranates blossomed strew, their bloom in blushes ever new, her hair in hyacinthines flew. Then when left to roll its folds below. Now, as you've noticed here, we have a hint of mysticism here. You know, when he says, her eyes immortal shone. Now, earlier in the same poem, Harfez's Garden of Love and Rose and Nightingale and the Breeze are invoked. I'm not going to read that for you because it's too long. Now, Harfez is invoked by name in Childe Harold's Pilgrim, coupled not altogether unexpectedly here with Anacreon. It says, that's on your handout. It is not that yon hoary lengthening beard ill suit the passions which belong to you. Love conquers age, so Harfez has averred. So sing the Teian. Teian is Anacreon, and he sings in suit. Now, in the works of Shelley, a title such as The Indian Serenade alerts us to look for something similar. Indeed, John Holloway has suggested that in both this poem and from the Arabic, an imitation, there is discernible the influence of Persian verse. From the Arabic, an imitation has definitely got echoes of the Ghazal in its handling of the rhyme scheme. I mean, you have got it on your handout, but I will only read the first stanza to save time. My faint spirit was sitting in the light of thy looks, my love. It panted for thee like the hind at noon for the brooks, my love. The barb whose hoofs outspeed the tempest's flight bore thee far from me, my heart for my weak feet, where weary soon did companion thee. So the rhyme scheme is there, and of course some of the imageries are very much Harfezian. I mean, the Indian Serenade shows a rather greater Harfezian influence on his imagery and diction, and the second stanza of the poem, again you have it on your handout. So the wandering airs they faint on the dark, the silent stream, like sweet thoughts in a dream. The nightingale's complaint, it dies upon her heart, as I must on thine, O beloved as thou art. Now, poets such as Byron and Shelley were eager to learn from the newly available resources of Oriental poetry, even if in the process these materials were too often erroneously assimilated to classical models. However, towards the middle of the 19th century, more central and more important was the work of Edward Bryce Cowell. Cowell's importance is twofold. Firstly, in terms of his own translations and writings about Harfez and other Persian poets. Secondly, because of his own influence upon other friends, notably in this context on Fitzgerald and Tennyson. I'm not going to go into detail in that because I have written elsewhere at length on the relation between Fitzgerald, Cowell, and Tennyson, and the way Tennyson became to learn Persian in order to read Hafez. He's the only poet, English poet of the period I know, who actually did learn Persian, and he read Hafez in the original as well as in translations. And the influences can readily be seen throughout his poetry. I mean, Tennyson was very, very much influenced, very much interested in mystical imageries and mystical language from a very early age. And a lot of his poetry are actually, you know, full of the imageries of Hafez. I mean, I have chosen a few passages here for you to read, and there's one sort of cluster of images which recur throughout with quite a lot of frequency in his poetry, and these are the images and symbols associated with the darkness of the beloved's head and eyes, and with the power and meaning of the glance of the eyes and the curls of the hair. This mystical imagery, as I said, you know, reappears throughout his poetry, but perhaps the locus classicus is found in his poem The Lover's Tale. And you've got passages in your handout, so I'll read it. The early passage says, "She was dark-haired, dark-eyed, oh, such dark eyes, a single glance of them will govern a whole life from birth to death, careless of all things else, led on with light. In trances and in visions, look at them, you lose yourself in utter ignorance. You cannot find their depth, for they go back." It's beautiful. And again, later on in the same poem, we have, "While I gazed, my spirit lit as with those thrills of bliss that strike across the soul in prayer and show us that we are surely heard. Methought a light burst from the garland I had woven and stood a solid glory on her bright black hair. A light, methought, broke for her dark, dark eyes and shot itself into the singing wind. A mystic light flashed even from her white robe, as from a glass in the sun, and fell about my footsteps in the mountains." Again, I mean, I have put, you have got a selection of other images in your handout, and I think I better skip reading them, because I will not get to the American poets otherwise. The only one I'd like to point out to you is one single image which he uses in his late poem, in Akbar's Dream, which is has been considered as a very Sufi poem. I mean, the rhyme scheme of this actually imitates Jones's translations of the Mu'allaqat. But he's got one line, he says, "We scarce can spell the aleph of thine alphabet of love." And here we have, "Nist balloh dalam juz aleph qamat yar, chekonam harf digar yad, nadad ostadam. On the tablet of my heart is inscribed no more than the aleph of the beloved's form. What can I do? The teacher taught me nothing beyond this letter." So, and this poem actually has been translated by Cowell as well. So, Tennyson is obviously the only poet who used Hafez, you know, extensively. And I will leave him to rest there, so I'll go back to the American poets. Now, about the same times as when Tennyson was beginning to study Persian at the other side of the Atlantic Radford. Emerson was also developing an enthusiasm for the poetry of Hafez. As early as 1835, he was telling a lecture audience that the works of Hafez were one of the sterling books, the books which should be read to the exclusion of the crowds of mediocre writers. The Persians read Hafez, the Chinese Confucius, and the Spaniards Cervantes. On the evidence of his journals and notebooks, his reading of Hafez became more thorough in the 1840s. His translations were made from the German of Joseph von Habers. The author is sometimes referred to as Baron von Hammer in Emerson's translation. Emerson's notebooks contain a number of partial and unrevised translations from Hafez. Emerson's comments on Hafez are both perceptive and on occasion gnomic. An entry from 1847 observes that a good scholar will find Aristophanes and Hafez and Rabelais full of American history. So I don't know how that can happen. So he finds Hafez characterized by a perfect intellectual emancipation, which he also provokes in the reader. Nothing stops him. He makes the their God and their devil experiment. He is not to be scared by a name or a religion. He fears nothing. He sees too far. He sees throughout. Such is the only man I wish to see and to be. Hafez, it appears in his touchstone for that poetry which is most capable of, quote, inoculating the reader with poetic madness. And he observes that words out of heaven are imparted to happy, incontrollable Pindars, Hafezes, Shakespeares, and not to be to Westminster assemblies of divines. He has shrewd critical comments to offer, suggesting that Hafez's poetry is marked by nothing more than his habit of playing with all magnitude, mocking at them. What is the moon or the sun's course or heaven and the angle and the angels to his darling's mole or eyebrow? Destiny is a scurvy night thief who plays him or her a bad trick. I might and perhaps will collect presently a few examples, though as I remember they occur passing in the divine. Naturally enough, Hafez is prominent in Emerson's essay of 1858 on the Persian poetry, contributed to the Atlantic Monthly. Many of the comments offered there are expansions of ideas contained in the notebooks. Like Cowell, he's aware of the inadequacy of earlier parallels between Hafez and Anacreon. He says, Hafez is the prince of Persian poets, and is he in his extraordinary gifts adds to some of the attributes of Pindar, Anacreon, Horace, and Burns, the insight of a mystic that sometimes affords a deeper glance at nature than belongs to either of these bards. Now, Hafez for Emerson, just as he was for Tennyson, more than just an Anacreonic poet. His enduring interest in our poet was more profound and substantial. His transcendentalist views found convenient vehicle in the ecstatic language of Hafez. About this time, Goethe's Divan was becoming very popular in America as well, and the transcendentalist movements were becoming more aware of the mystical language of Hafez. Now, to elucidate how this translations which Emerson did reflected in his own poetry, I'm going to quote just one. Well, it is a long poem. I probably will read only two passages. You've got it all on your handout. He wrote the first translations he did from Hafez was the Saqinameh, and he wrote two poems called both of them called Bacchus. And both of them are very much influenced by Hafez. He's got one complete Bacchus and one fragmentary one. I'm going to, the fragmentary one has been sort of talked about by John Yohanan, so I will go on to the complete Bacchus, and I will read the first two stanzas, and you've got the third one there. He says, "Bring me wine, but wine which never grew in the belly of the grape, or grew on vine whose tap roots reaching through under the Andes to the Cape, suffer no savour of the earth to escape. We buy ashes for bread, we buy diluted wine. Give me of the true, whose ample leaves and tender is curled among the silver hills of heaven. Draw everlasting dew, blood of the world, form of forms, a mold of statures that I intoxicated, and by the draught assimilated, may float at pleasure through all nature." Now we have lines like "Bia Saqiyan, make a hal avarat, keramat fazayat kamal avarat," bring Saqi that wine which enlivens the spirit, increases generosity, and gives perfection. And there's many, many lines like this in Hafez. Now, Emerson was very interested in wine imagery, as we have seen. Just like Hafez's poem, wine was an image to be used to explain his mystical intoxication, his mystical feelings. The language of the poem is like that of Hafez, is actually in the imperative, is addressing, you know, the Bacchus, the god of life, as Hafez addresses Saqi. Now, leaving Emerson behind, we have here two of his protégés, David Thoreau and Walt Whitman. I mean, they were both interested in Persian poetry, and I'm not going to go to any details here, because first of all, Thoreau became very interested in Sa'di's, and Whitman was very much influenced by Rumi. But both of them actually do use images from Hafez. Whitman uses, you know, literally translations in the Leaves of Grass. Right, I will finish soon. Now, the other American poet which I would like to mention, it's actually Herman Melville. He definitely wasn't a transcendentalist. As Yohanan points out, he was both a disciple and an apostate from Emerson. Both putting aside his apostasy here, we consider Emerson's and therefore Hafez's influence on Melville. Melville, like Emerson, became interested in the imagery of wine. In Mardi, a work of fiction, Hafez is the Persian Anacreon. He mentions Hafez by name, and in a passage sort of late on, there's one of the characters who's a cosmopolitan, sort of explains to a mystic that, "As for wine, my regard for that beverage is so extreme, and I am so fearful of letting it sate me, that I keep my love for it in the lasting conditions of untried abstraction. Briefly, I quaff immense draughts of wine from the pages of Hafez, but wine from a cup I seldom as much as a sip." So he's got a poem later on, which he wrote after a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. This is quite interesting, and you've got it on your handout. Here, Hafez is inquisitioned, as it were, by Didymus. And here, Didymus, we're talking about Thomas Didymus, the disciple of Christ, who became as Thomas the Doubter, who had to touch and see everything to believe it. So here we have the poem. "To Hafez in grape arbor comes Didymus with book he thumbs. My Lord Harfors, priest of bowers, flowers in such a world as ours. Who is the god of all these flowers? Senior Didymus, who knows? Nonetheless, I take repose, believe and worship here with wine, in vaulted chapel of the vine, before the altar of the rose. So, you know, I think the two are put as opposites here to show that really Harfors is the imagination, is the power, is the imaginative power, whereas Didymus is, you know, the physical sort of wants proof of anything physical. You know, if you know he's all made by God, where is he? You know. So briefly, as we have seen, you know, Harfors really exerted quite an important influence on poetry, both in England and in America, and we all are we really must be much gratitude to the early Orientalists, you know, to Jones, to E.B. Cowell, and others. And of course, we mustn't forget Goethe's Divan here, who was also crucial in expanding and advancing the understanding of Harfors's true, you know, language of love in the English world. You know, all the Romantics and later poets, they all read Goethe and took advantage of him. So here we are. That's, I will not go any further. I think we've come to our time anyway.